I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Stressed about pests? When you have pest problems, don't call just anyone. Call the Orkin Pro. For more than 120 years, Orkin offers unparalleled service, helping protect homes and businesses from termites, rodents, mosquitoes, and other insects. With Orkin by your side, you don't have to wonder about the outcome of your pest problem. We'll solve it guaranteed. And if bugs creep up between services, we'll be on your doorstep free of charge. Orkin, the best in pests. Learn more at Orkin.com.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the Cricket Podcast, where we answer your questions on cricket. Remember, you can go over to patreon.com/Jared Kimber, and you can ask questions beforehand on whichever membership tier allows you to do that. Like a bunch of people have, like Ben King has, and we'll answer his in a moment. But if you're in the chat, feel free to ask questions via Super Chat, but also just normal comments as well. We can try and get to as many as we want. I don't know how busy or how many questions we have today, but we'll certainly give it a good go. But let's start with Ben's question. He says, Ian Botham was a very good cricketer. I think that's safe to say. But how could he have been if he had been fully committed off the field, practice eating right, not getting sloshed every single night, etc.? We know that he didn't bowl or bat particularly well in the fourth innings. So a quarter of the game, he wasn't anywhere near the level that he should have been, right? So that's instantaneous, and we're all aware of that. Well, we're not all aware of that, but I did a video on it not that long ago, so people would have seen my work on that. So, yes, I think that played a big part. He didn't make the most out of his incredible natural athleticism. His game probably didn't develop. I almost feel like his bowling did and his batting didn't. So his bowling, I feel like he did. I was going to say I felt like he kept developing, but I mean, maybe looking back, he didn't. I think he was just so much more naturally talented than anyone else that he just thought he could keep getting by with that. And even when his record wasn't as good as it used to be, he still believed he was the same player who had been that. So, yeah, I don't know how much better he would have been. To be Ian Botham, I think you need an incredible ego and self-belief. But he maybe did not have some of the other motivations that we've seen from players of his level. And you might be able to put Sobers in this as well, although I think Sobers was much more of a student of the game than Botham was. I think Botham sometimes thought learning and developing and trying new things was beneath him because he didn't need to do that. Whereas if you compare him to Imran Khan, who clearly was working on his game right until the end to become a better player, I think you can see the difference. So I think Kapil Dev is a better player than Ian Botham. And I think that Ian Botham could have been a much better player than Kapil Dev. So I don't know if he could have ever got... I don't think he was a good enough bat to be on that Sobers level. But if he'd worked on his game, if he'd kept himself fit, if he'd looked after himself and everything, perhaps he would have got to that level. But you, as I just said, you might be able to make a similar argument for Sobers, who also enjoyed nightlife and didn't go to bed before games and all sorts of things. So I don't know how much of a difference it would have made to Botham, but I do think a big part of Botham's mystique was the, I don't want to say I don't care, but that sort of I'm better than you anyway attitude. Does that go away if he becomes a diligent professional? I know that sounds weird, but I don't know. But yes, I do think he could have been a much better cricketer than he was. I think he's clearly still a great of the game, but it's probably the difference between him being in the S tier and not, and he's probably not quite at that level. And on talent alone, he definitely should have been at that level. Ben says, both red and pink balls are dyed, so theoretically made roughly the same way, but with different dyes, I assume. Having used them in club cricket, pink balls are rock hard compared to the red balls. They hit the bat really hard and are real stingers in the field. Why is this? So I don't know, but you're right, because I've used them as well. They are definitely very, very different. The pink ball, I would say, is dyed in a different way. And so one of the reasons that the red dye works so well is because it goes on so naturally. And I would say, again, the pink ball probably has extra lacquer, which might make it a little bit harder. But I don't know how much cricket you played around the world, Ben, and with how many different balls. But there are red balls that are also way harder than others. And there are red balls that, you know, I can't remember the name of the ball, but there was a particular ball I used to hate being into the slips with. And it wasn't the catches I had the problem. It was the ones that bounced in front of you. It just always felt like I was going to break my finger with this particular ball. And they just, every time I hit my hand, I'd be, you know, it would sting me for ages. So I do think that that is a common thing. And there is something about the pink dye that is different, but the pink ball is made differently than the red ball. And so the red ball is made differently than the pink ball, and the pink ball is made differently than the white ball, which is also made differently than the red ball. So they're all separate, which means that they should all feel different in your hands and feel different off your bat. I think that is correct from what I, certainly from anecdotally having played with all those balls. Also, and I don't know if I've ever talked about this, but I find white balls almost impossible to bowl with. Maybe around the 8th or 10th over when all the paint peels off them, but they're just so slippery, whereas I never had that issue with a pink ball. Bloody says, when Rory Burns and Sibley were making dull scores, I trusted the process. Seeing off the new ball shine is traditionally the job of openers, but in the end they were dropped. Has cricket's meta evolved? Many years ago, would Burns and Sibley have been appreciated? Additionally, do you think there's a fundamental issue with county cricket in that it produces batters like Burns and Sibley? So the thing about that is, I don't think there's really any era where someone averaging under 30 is really all that appreciated. You have players who are appreciated for it at times, but maybe they bring other things to the table, or there's just no one else that you can pick and they still give you something. I'm thinking of, what would Jeff Marsh's average have been in Test cricket? I can't imagine. I mean, he would have been more than those two, but he wouldn't have been massively more, would he? 50 tests, he averages 33. And eventually he is dropped, right? And he maintains his one-day role in which, basically him and Desmond Haynes, or still more than Desmond Haynes in Jeff Marsh's case, but invent that anchor position. You've got there another player who is very widely respected within cricket, but still lost his position. You see this a lot with New Zealand openers who can stay in forever, but can't make any runs. Eventually they are dropped. You don't get, let's see if we can find this. Actually, this would be a really interesting one. To see if there is anyone in the history of cricket, certainly post-war anyway, who has averaged under 35 as an opener. Where are we? Openers. Under 35 as an opener for 75 tests. Even if we go 35 tests. So I've come up with one in what's his name? Who did I just come up with? Jeff Marsh. All right. So if we go average and we're looking at openers. Okay. So Sherwin Campbell, Jeff Marsh, Graham Wood, Craig Brathwaite. Right? So Graham Wood, again, plays in that era where it's the Kerry Packer era and gets a lot of extra tests that he probably wouldn't have got if the team had been full strength. Sherwin Campbell comes in, what, around 95, 94, plays in a seven-year period where they just can't find any other openers. They rotate through a whole bunch and he doesn't really work. Jeff Marsh, again, plays in a poor era of Australian cricket, does the best that he can. And then you've got Craig Brathwaite, who you would have as another kind of player who is on that kind of level of they can't find anyone better, and he gets some respect, but everyone knows that he's a very limited player and still not averaging over 35. And if you look at that next level above, you've got Mohammad Nasir, Mohammad Hafeez, John Wright, Dean Elgar, Tamim Iqbal, Mike Atherton, Murali Vijay, Tom Latham. They're the other guys who average under 40 as an opening batter who've played more than 50 games. So we've never respected them. Well, sorry, no, respect is the wrong word, bloody. We have never just kept people in because they can take the shine off the new ball. You have to also match that with runs. Mark Richardson is a player who was an absolute delacquerer of cricket balls, right, over a long period of time. He would stay in for a long period of time, but he also averaged in the 40s. And I think if you can manage to do that, you get respected. If you average in the 30s or even below that, you don't, and you don't stick around. So I actually don't think cricket has evolved from that. The difference is now we probably have less patience for that. Oh my God, Muku's playing his shots here. Rem Kumar, I don't even know where to read. He's put this in such a weird spot on the screen. Rem Kumar says, in increasing order of difficulty of matches for India for the last 9 semi-final World Cups. Oh my God. Okay, so he's coming up with his own. So this is in order of difficulty, in increasing order of difficulty. Okay, so he's got 2017 Champions Trophy and the 2023 World Test Championship Final. What's he got at number 8? World Cup semi-final against Australia. So he's saying they should have won the 2017 tournament, should have won the 2023 tournament. They should have won the 2014. 2014 is weird because I think we have forgotten how brilliant Sri Lanka was and how they should have won a whole bunch of titles. But okay, he's got the 2019 semi-final against New Zealand. But that was tricky because it was tricky because the days. 2016 semi-final against the West Indies. I mean, they were a fantastic side, weren't they? 2021 World Test Championship Final. Certainly conditions helped New Zealand massively there. 2022 T20 World Cup. T20 World Cup. He's got that in here. I'm not sure what that means. Does he mean the England game? It says against India, but against England. No, I think they should have been better in that one. Yeah. And then he's got the World Test Championship Final against Australia. And I wouldn't have the World Test Championship Final against Australia as the hardest one. The 2015 World Semi-Final against Australia, I would, because that team was absolutely roaring. And I'd probably have the 2016 T20 World Cup higher as well. And maybe the 2021 World Test Championship Final, because that New Zealand team was just stacked and perfect for those conditions. Josh says, Murali versus Ashwin. The one-man army versus the destroyer of left-handers. Murali smashed the smaller teams. Ashwin is unplayable in India. Who's the better test offie? These two greats. Is Ashwin's batting... Ashwin's batting is massive compared to the two of them. It's a good question, Josh. I've never gone through it. I mean, I just obviously did a big video where we looked at Ashwin versus Kumble, and Kumble's numbers come off really, really good. I would assume that Murali is a better bowler than Ashwin, even if you take out the mini wickets against Zimbabwe and Bangladesh. And towards the end of his career, Murali was equally unplayable against left-handers. He just wasn't all the way through his career. But I would find it hard to think that Murali wasn't the better bowler than Ashwin. I think he was a bigger threat everywhere. But if you are saying better cricketer and you're putting batting back in, that does change things a lot because, you know, being able to average 20 to 25 in test cricket, you know, Murali was a proper 10 and 11, right? So there is a big difference there. Whether it's enough to go in Ashwin's favour, I don't think so. I mean, I would always, I'm not a big fan of handy number eights. I would always pick the better bowler in that situation. And I find it very hard to believe that Murali was not the better bowler than Ashwin. Rudra says, if T20, but that, I should just caveat that with, I have never compared the two, so I don't know 100%. Rudra says, if T20s were played on Indian test wickets of the last couple of years, not including the recent England series, what team should India pick? and what team should a team like India or South Africa that is bad at playing spin do in cases of terms? Okay, so if we're saying we're playing a T20 matches, but we're playing them on their wickets that were turning sideways for India in test matches, you would play what? Patata, Dubey. You want Raidu or Raina to come out of retirement. Gaikwad would be another player. Sai Sudarshan might come in. Shubman Gill would probably play. Rohit probably plays because he played brilliantly on those wickets, didn't he? And I'm trying to think, who would you have as your death hitter if you're India in that situation? Might you bring in someone like Abhishek? I mean, Abhishek might actually get into the side naturally as the opener as well. Oh, and Sky. Sky would be in there as well, wouldn't he? And Tilak Varma wouldn't be far away. I've probably got too many batters now. And then bowlers, you would have Chahal, Kuldeep, Akshar, Jadeja, Ashwin. And you'd use Hardik as a seamer, wouldn't you? And you'd have Bumrah. So that's what's had about 13, 14 players to pick your side from. I think that seems fair. What would England do? They'd sweep everything. Where would England have? I don't think England have that many. I mean, Duckett would probably play. Dan Lawrence might come in to that kind of lineup. Does Milan come back? I know he's not a brilliant player of spin, but he could stick around against it, I suppose. Yeah, and then you would have Hartley, Moeen, Dawson, Parkinson. Adil, yeah, may not be Parkinson anymore, but A-League spinner perhaps. Benny Howe should probably have played in that side as well. And what would South Africa do? South Africa would probably be okay these days because they've got Klaassen in the middle. They've got Miller in the middle. Temba might play in that one again. I'm trying to think of some. Rassi perhaps, being able to not go out. So, yeah, and then they would have Maharaj, Harmer, Tabray Shamsi, is it George Lindy? That guy, whose name I've now forgotten, would be a player that would come in. Markram would definitely play, and you'd probably bowl him a little bit more. That's a really interesting question. I like the thinking behind that, Rudra. Thank you very much. Let's have a quick break here, and then when we come back, there will be more questions on cricket and more things that we talk about right here on The Wagon Wheel. Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing. Complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Stressed about pests? When you have pest problems, don't call just anyone. Call the Orkin Pro. For more than 120 years, Orkin offers unparalleled service, helping protect homes and businesses from termites, rodents, mosquitoes, and other insects. With Orkin by your side, you don't have to wonder about the outcome of your pest problem. We'll solve it guaranteed. And if bugs creep up between services, we'll be on your doorstep free of charge. Orkin, the best in pests. Learn more at Orkin.com.
Welcome back to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Cooper. William Tench says, is there a reason why cricket grounds don't have roofs? They're really expensive, William. Is there something officially prohibiting it? No, because obviously Docklands has one in Australia. It's about expenses as much as anything. Cricket grounds are much bigger than other stadium to cover. So they are more expensive than, you know, a tennis court or what's another sport that covers its grounds? Football, you know, things like that. It's just bigger. The individual grounds don't play as many games. So look at Lords. They play what? 4 major games a year. So what's that? 12 days of cricket. Maybe 15 days of cricket on a really big year. And then a bunch of lower level stuff. Most international grounds in the world are not playing anywhere near what Lords is playing. Right? And so the idea of then covering the grounds is really, really hard. From a financial model. So Docklands is covered, but the reason it's covered has nothing to do with cricket. It's because Aussie Rules football, right? And they play a lot more Aussie Rules football there, and that pays its way. How many international grounds in the year would have 50 or 60 games being played at the arena that would get back that kind of money? And then you would have to factor in how much cricket you were losing. I know this is the case in England, but I would assume this is around the world as well. A lot of the boards are insured for rain losses. So it doesn't matter as much to the local board. It does, because, you know, there are some things that they can never get back from having a washed out game, but they do make some of their money back. So all those things are a part of it. Trying to think what else. We haven't really come up with a great system to put covers on existing grounds. So it would have to be a new ground in order to do that. And most of our grounds are quite old. So it's easy. If you're building a stadium from scratch, it's easier to put a roof on, which is why the Docklands has one, right? It is very hard to put a roof on Trent Bridge, where all the stands are a different size. You then have planning permissions in some places and everything else. So it's not easy. It just, you know, I think we will work it out in the future, but it's just not particularly easy. Ian says, thinking about wicketkeeper batters in red ball cricket, is there any merit in a team batting at totally different positions depending on the structure of the game? Take Alex Stewart as an example. Would it be sensible for him have him to bat in the top three if he bat first in a game and thus when he's fresh, which would most likely result in him having a longer rest? I like this. I mean, I like flexibility in batting orders. I think where you would get an issue would be the way that batters think about batting positions. No one wants to be top three in the second innings, but number five in the first innings would be my guess. And then you also need someone who is versatile enough to be able to swap with Alex Stewart in those positions. But your basic principle is correct. And if we ever get away from the tyranny of the batting card, which I think is held cricket back for a long time, I think you could have more ability to do stuff like this. But most players bat in the positions they do because of their technical skills. So it's not as easy to say, oh, we're just going to move this player down to this position over and over again. It doesn't always work exactly like that. But your overall thinking, I really like. Josh shares, Ravindra Jadeja versus Shane Warne. Josh, did you not just do Miralee versus Ashwin? Warne is a better bowler and can hold a bat and is a good slip fielder. Jadeja surprisingly has a better bowling average, helped by dominating in India, is a genuine all-rounder. and is one of the greatest fielders of all time. Who is the better test player? Oh, better test player. Again, I probably generally always would default to the better bowler. And I don't think anyone would believe that Jadeja is a better bowler than Warne. Jadeja away from Asia is a good bowler, but he's more of a holding good bowler. Whereas Warne everywhere, except for probably India, was a strike bowler who could also hold at the same time. Warne also didn't have, as you said, the benefit of the conditions at home being in his favour. In fact, in some cases, they went the other way, right? They made the pitches a little bit more helpful for seam bowling because they had so many seamers, they only had one spinner. Warne is a handy batter. Jadeja can bat at number six, right? And even number five, if you need him to. Warne couldn't even bat at seven. So there's a big difference there. But Warne was a pretty good slip fielder, wasn't he? And Jadeja is a better all-round fielder, clearly, but that's not as important in Test match cricket as probably being a good attacking fielder. I would pick Warne. Yeah, I'd pick Warne because I think you can also make a case for Warne being the best bowler of all time. Even though his average is, as you say, higher than someone like Jadeja's and certainly higher than Joel Garner's and Malcolm Marshall's and Curly Ambrose and Glenn McGrath's. I think you can make a claim that Warne is the best bowler of all time. I don't think you can with Jadeja, and I'm more than willing to go with the bowling. But I don't think there's as much between it as all-round cricketers. It would be really interesting to know how many people would actually pick Jadeja. What is it? Maybe 20% of people would pick Jadeja, and I don't think they're wrong, right? I think you can certainly make an argument in either direction if you wanted to. But having watched Jadeja bowl home and away, even though his away record is not terrible, and also the thing with Jadeja is he's a really good cricketer at many different things. Teams were terrified of Shane Warne. He destroyed entire teams' planning. That impact allowed for the other players on his team to do well because everyone was so focused on Warne. Jessica says, in his tour diaries, Ricky Ponting lamented that it was unrealistic to ever select Ian Harvey for the Australian test team. Ponting said this despite Harvey's decent Shield record. But then, over the next few years, Australia would select Simon and Watson for the team in the exact role that Harvey would have played. So was my boy cheated out of a test cap? Your boy was cheated out of a test cap by Adam Gilchrist. Because I think if Harvey was going to play test cricket, he was going to bat at number seven. And if Gilchrist had batted at six, which Australia never quite went with, they then would have had the ability. Actually, it wasn't just Gilchrist. He was cheated out of a position by Gilchrist, by McGrath, and by Warne. So Gilchrist gave them an all-rounder, right? So they then had seven frontline batters and they had four frontline bowlers. Would they have preferred to have five frontline bowlers and six frontline batters? No, because they could have done that with Gilchrist and they never wanted to. So they wanted that. And so once they had that really strong number seven, Harvey was always going to be a worse number seven than Adam Gilchrist. Now, so that makes it a little bit hard on that side of things. And Harvey was my favorite player growing up, right? So I say all this as someone, and I think he was, as someone who watched a lot of cricket, I actually think Harvey was a better first-class cricketer than he was a white ball cricketer, right? So what would Harvey have averaged in test cricket? I'm just having a look here. His first-class average is 34. I think he was sometimes got very very bored in first-class batting. And if he played test cricket, I think we would have seen the best out of him. But I think he still averages around 28, right? So if he bats at number seven, you've got more like an Ian Healy-type record, Rod Marsh-type batter. And he's a better batter than Rod Marsh and Ian Healy. I think he was more destructive, made a lot more first-class hundreds. But he would have averaged roughly the same. But he would have done it in that sort of... Harvey probably would have made 100 better than a runner ball. Probably would have made 200s better than a runner ball, but he also would have failed a lot. His bowling was much better in first-class cricket than he probably even was in limited overs cricket. So his bowling average in first-class cricket was bowling average of 27. But he had two skills. One was the ability to swing the ball consistently forever. And the other was that he almost never went for runs. He was almost a complete different kind of bowler and batter, like incredible cavalier batter just swinging out of his ass. And then when he bowled, the most defensive bowler. The amount of times I saw him bowl like an entire session for Victoria and go for like 20, 25 runs. He just seemed to bowl forever, right? It was just like wide out swing, sort of like Callis, but, you know, 10, 15 Ks slower, but with a wicketkeeper up at the stump, and Darren Berry would just take them over and over and over again. So the problem with that is that Australia didn't need that kind of bowler because Glenn McGrath and Shane Warne, they had two of the best strike bowlers of all time and two of the best stock ball bowlers of all time. So they didn't need that extra bowler in that way. And so in that period when Ian Harvey was at his peak, which is what, probably 98, probably 98 to 2003, 4 would be my guess. In that particular part of his game, they had other options, Jessica, right? I think when Andrew Symon starts to play and Watson starts to play, the Australian seamers are a little bit older and Gilchrist is probably, I'm going to go back to the bowlers. I think the bowlers start to get a little bit older and they start to, and they also don't have the Mark Waugh, Steve Waugh overs as much at that point. Michael Clark bowls a little bit, but, you know, because of his back, can't always bowl, et cetera, et cetera. But I also think they just started to think differently because if you eventually they end up with Andrew McDonald. Now, I watched a lot of Andrew McDonald and a lot of Ian Harvey, and Andrew McDonald is a really underrated cricketer, but he was nowhere near as good a player as Ian Harvey was. So if you swap them in eras, Harvey probably plays 30, 35 tests. I think he averages 28 with the ball and 36, 28 with the bat and 36 with the ball with probably a really low economy. I'm not sure he ends up as a success, but he was easily talented enough to play test cricket. And had he been playing for Australia in another era, or if he'd been playing for any other country, I think a lot of teams would have brought him in. He was a much more dynamic version of Mark Elam, right? Like more talented than Mark Elam. I just want to have a look at Mark Elam's record. So Mark Elam with the bat, average 31 with 1300s. So if Harvey was certainly a much better first-class bat than him, even if their record is similar-ish. And then in first-class cricket, Elam had a very, very similar record. And Elam goes on to play 8 tests. And Elam was, I don't think he was a better bat or a better bowler than Harvey. So I think Harvey was a slight plus on both of those. And also Harvey was one of the most gifted fielders you'll ever see as well. I could throw with both arms and do just incredible things out on a cricket field. I mean, his nickname was the Freak because of what he could do. So I think sometimes you just end up in the wrong situation at the wrong time. Roger says, if the World Cup pitches in the Caribbean are bowler friendly, will Australia miss being able to call on Smith? Who else can play the role of a proper batter for them if they lose too many wickets? Well, Warner is technically also there for that same kind of position. I think there will be a time when Williamson is quite handy for New Zealand. So I thought they would go with Smith in this particular case, but I think now they are more throwing themselves into that other side of the of everything and going into the attack mode, not quite with the Fraser McGurk, but with everyone else. But you're right, it might come back to bite them, Rudra, but I still think this is a better T20 team than they've had before. Especially from the batting perspective. Satchmo says, why didn't Australia become stronger during the World Series cricket despite playing against the world's best? Was it personnel too old, no Border or Kim Hughes? Why didn't they become stronger during World Series cricket? Well, because their best players weren't playing for Australia at that time. So World Series cricket was a split. So, you know, you didn't always have all the best players playing. I think there's a generation of Australian players that were aging out, and obviously the next generation wasn't as strong. I think, you know, up until 88, 89, Australia is pretty weak. So that World Series cricket and the players playing in World Series cricket were the older guys who were already out of the team. You know, Ian Chappell and Greg Chappell, those sorts of guys were, you know, well and truly out by the mid-80s. Yeah. And so the players who were played the most in World Series cricket didn't actually play all that much for Australia afterwards. But I think it was more a generational thing. You know, they had Lillian Tomo in the 70s, and then Tomo had slowed down. Lillie becomes sort of a decent bowler up until the 80s, but doesn't have a lot of great partnerships. They never had a spinner. Bruce Reid should have been their great bowler, but they couldn't keep him on the park. Craig McDermott had a lot of skill, or natural talent, I should say, but was injury prone. You know, they just didn't have a very good attack that could consistently do stuff. And they lost a generation of, you know, they lost Marsh, Lillie, Chappell all in one go. I think you're misremembering how the Australian team was, but that was why they went into a weaker era. It had nothing to do with World Series cricket, because the players who were playing against World Series cricket were considered some of the best players in the world. Jessica said, once upon a time, I had a colourful disagreement with an older cricket nerd over whether or not it was fair to sarcastically, mockingly refer to the likes of Mike Brearley and Mike Dennis as gentlemen, because in my eyes, they only had their places in the English Test team because of their pedigree, not their quality of batting. It's an interesting one. I have certainly done this before. I reckon I might have even had this conversation with Mike Brearley a few years ago as well. So Mike Dennis averages 39. And in first class, in test cricket, over 28 matches, but his first class record was like 33, right? And obviously Mike Brearley was worse than probably both of those marks. He certainly would have been worse than that. He certainly would have been worse. Wait, yeah, Mike Dennis, Mike Brearley. Mike Brearley played 39 tests and averaged 23 with a bat. I'm just going to pause there so you can all have that. He was a better first-class player, though, 25,000 runs at an average of 37.8. So maybe Mike Dennis probably made more runs at test level than he should have. And Mike Brearley probably made fewer runs at test level than he should have. Never made 100, amazingly. Made 45 first-class 100s. So Mike Brearley was not a dud. But certainly at test cricket, he wouldn't have. Here's the best test of whether you can mockingly call them gentlemen. Would either of these players played as many test matches and been the captain of their teams if they had been professionals from a working class background? And the answer is no, right? That's not downgrading who they are as players or why they were picked or anything like that. But the answer is no. They would not have been playing for England if they had come in from the mines on a Saturday and produced those numbers for as long as they did. They certainly wouldn't have gone on to be captains, right? That doesn't mean that they didn't have great captaincy skills. It doesn't mean that Mike Dennis actually outperformed his first class numbers when he played test cricket, right? Which is a great thing to do himself. But if you come from a background, you certainly have, and I don't know as much about Mike Dennis, to be honest, but certainly in Brearley's case, you know, the idea of being the right kind of person from the right kind of family, you know, with the right kind of accent, played a big part in Brearley. I don't think that means he wasn't a great captain. I just think that if he had an identical record and was, a coal miner's son, he probably doesn't play 39 tests and average 23 and be the captain of the side, right? So there is his class and his background did play a part in him getting that role, right? Don't think anyone should argue against that. And so if you're mockingly using the term gentleman, I think that's fair, right? If you're actually saying he's a gentleman, I think it's not quite fair. And I think he deserved to get it. If he was as good as the captain as it looks like he was, and he was averaging nearly 40 in first-class cricket, there are plenty of England players who've been picked with those numbers, no matter their background. But they don't usually continue to play and captain the side when they're averaging 23, right? So his opportunity, I have no issue with. And as I said, with Mike Dennis, he actually outperformed his first class numbers. So I don't know as much about Mike Dennis as a person or as a cricketer or the overall system. But just looking at those numbers there, I would say he probably deserved to continue to get picked, depending on the era and what the other batters were that were available. We'll take a break here, and then after the break, we'll be back with more questions on the Wagon Wheel.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Stressed about pests? When you have pest problems, don't call just anyone. Call the Orkin Pro. For more than 120 years, Orkin offers unparalleled service, helping protect homes and businesses from termites, rodents, mosquitoes, and other insects. With Orkin by your side, you don't have to wonder about the outcome of your pest problem. We'll solve it guaranteed. And if bugs creep up between services, we'll be on your doorstep free of charge. Orkin, the best in pests. Learn more at Orkin.com.
Reboot says, I don't think I've seen a question from Reboot before. Are we seeing a basketballification of T20 cricket? With the Warriors dynasty starting, the Splash Brothers, the NBA basically realized that three was better than two, and you could score more points if you shoot more threes. Eventually, other teams caught on where even the big men like Brook Lopez and Joel Embiid start shooting more. Yeah, it's interesting when you look at basketball because almost every year on end, they shot more threes. So we always look for the big bang when things change, but if you actually go back to the, you know, to the start of whenever the ABA 3-point line was brought into the NBA, it's like year on year there's an increase. There's like one little spike when they made the 3-point line shorter, so everyone shot a lot more that year, but generally it's just this natural progression up, right? And if you look at ODI cricket, which we have a much better history of, it's exactly the same, right? Just this natural progression of, yeah, we're scoring a little bit quicker. And so we are now looking at something a little bit different in more, and T20 cricket is a little bit more random, especially because of the way it was played early on. And it's not as level and as ODI cricket has been. And then, but we haven't had as much of a natural progression with that. But the last couple of years, we have had scoring rates go up. The Kookaburra ball is harder. And I think for the first couple of years, the wobble ball caused some issues at the top. And now teams have worked out how to handle that. And so what they do after, and so the ball stays a little bit harder for longer, which means you could score more runs. The impact sub has obviously played a big part in the IPL specifically, but most leagues in the world have had, you know, in the last 2 years have had probably, if not their highest scoring season ever, then their second highest scoring season ever. So it's certainly getting to that point. But the West Indies were saying this in 2012, they were telling the world, if I'm going to take a risk, I'm going to take a risk on a six rather than on a single or trying to run a two. And it makes sense the more you think about it, right? Nothing frustrates me more than people getting run out in a power play. I would much rather a dot ball than a single in a power play. I do not understand why you would do that unless you cannot play the bowler you're facing and you have to get off strike. And if that's the case, you know, maybe you would do it. Rem Kumar says, is this World Cup more open than the ODI 2023, T20 2022, T20 2021? Well, 2023 was very much India, wasn't it? And they had it all the way through to the last game. T20 in 2022, England got injured. So if England weren't injured, are they probably going to win that again? I mean, who knows? Australia might still knock them off in the final. So I would have said that we had a pretty clear leader. Oh, no, 2022 is the one that England won. 2021 is what I'm thinking of. So 2022 and 2021 should have been England probably both times and wasn't because of injuries in one and then they won the other one. I think the most likely winner is from Australia, India, and England again. But I don't, if you were to ask me who to bet on, I probably wouldn't bet on India just because they're really, really short. But I think that the most obvious winner is probably from those teams. But South Africa have a really, really interesting side. I don't think any other side can win it. So maybe that gives us four potential winners. And I wonder if any of those other tournaments, there's been a legitimate four winners that could come into the tournament. I'd have to go back and think about it, Ram, but I don't think so. Ali says, with the IPL taking up more and more of international cricket's calendar, how are smaller and upcoming boards supposed to invest in their cricket infrastructure at grassroots and grow the game domestically? Does it not mean that the shrinkage of the game and players pool instead of growth, since only a few boards will be the only ones to invest in a new crop of players? Well, no, because boards will make more money off local leagues than they do from international cricket anyway, and the World Cup will still give them the same amount of development money. So no, there's more money in the game now than there has been at any other time for most teams ever. So I'm not quite sure what you mean of that. Shrinkage of the game, I mean, it's already wider than it's ever been. More people playing from more different places. So, I think that's very, very different. Does it mean, since only a few boards will be the one able to invest? I mean, that's always been the case, though. Boards have never really invested in their players. It's been an amateur sport, and yet we've still got more players and more countries now than ever before. So if there's more money at the IPL, there will be more people trying to get their players to the IPL, whether that is boards or agents or whatever, hangers-on, coaches, etc., etc. People will still be trying to do that. If you're the coach of a young kid who makes it to the IPL, that, let's say you're a private batting coach to a young kid from Zimbabwe who makes it to the IPL, you're going to be able to sell your services so much better for having got that kid there that you're going to keep trying to develop other kids to be able to do the same sorts of things anyway. The overall market of cricket is so much bigger, and you could sell your kids to Major League Cricket or you could sell them anywhere else. So I don't really understand what you're talking about here, Ali, because I think you're thinking that boards had invested lots of money in players before, and they didn't, right? Up until the 1980s, did any cricket board ever really invest money in players? I would say no. They just hosted games. And the games are still being played, and there are more games being played now, and there are more scouts, and there are more ways to get paid. So I can't understand how that would ever shrink it. Ribu says, I've already done that one. This IPL, I don't know who wrote this one, sorry. But this IPL is suggesting the teams have definitely learned that six is better than four. And with the impact sub, you can really go after it. This might be from Ribu's question as well, I'm not sure. Basketball has fundamentally changed even at lower levels like the NCAA. How will cricket change, especially with the balance of red ball and white ball? Will they just become two separate sports with only a few players overlapping, like rugby union and rugby league? I think that's probably the best case scenario for red ball cricket, is they should separate. But players are still more than welcome to change. I don't know that much about racing cars, but isn't that kind of what happens with racing cars? You have Indy drivers, you have Formula One drivers. Occasionally they swap over. And then you have some other, major driving leagues around the world where people will often go off in those and try out there as well. So yes, I would assume cricket will go down that kind of a route. I don't think the same people should be running T20 cricket. They should be running Test cricket anyway, or ODI cricket. I think they should all be run for themselves. I don't think that really helps anything. Ram Kumar says, who is India going to miss more at this World Cup? Abhishek Sharma, Rinku Singh, or Natarajan? Natarajan's an interesting one, because if you have Bumrah and Natarajan, can you not use Bumrah earlier on more? So he only needs to bowl 17 and 19. And Natarajan could bowl, 16, 18, 20. And then you can use Bumrah for one early on and one in the middle whenever you need him. Abhishek Sharma in the West Indies, though, could be just change things completely, couldn't he? I don't know how they fit Rinku into this side, only because of Hardik, Jadeja, and Akshar. So I think while I don't know if you're missing Rinku, it's just that he doesn't have a second skill and they probably need to play with the second skill. And they're going to want to bat to number 8 or 9 even at times. And so Rinku's not going to fit into that. So whether they miss him or not, I don't know if they fit him in. It's probably Abhishek Sharma, I would say. Ram Kumar says, if someone had told Indian fans in the late 80s and 90s that India would have 5 runner-ups and 4 semifinals and 10 previous ICC tournaments, how would they react? Probably be pretty happy. I mean, expectations change, right? If you told someone in 1975 that South Africa would perennially be one of the best bilateral teams in the world, you know, from what, 1994 until now, I suppose, I think South African fans would be over the moon. But if you keep losing big games that you should have won or are failing in tournaments that you're second favorite for or third favorite for consistently, your expectations change. You have got to that other level. That's just life. I think if you told someone in the 1930s or 1920s that India was going to have a record like you've just said now, they would be the most excited person in the world, right? They would just be over the moon with that. But the world has changed and India has changed and Indian fans are very different. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I think this is all the subcontinent, but I know I've looked this up for India and I think Bangladesh, but they are incredibly young societies, right? So, you know, I live in England. It's a much older society. I think most of the West is aging up. And a lot of other societies around the world, like, you know, in Asia and Africa, are much younger. I think I've got that right. But certainly I know in India, the median age of people is really, really low. These people have grown up winning the 2007 World Cup, winning the 2011 World Cup, being the most dominant force on the field, being the most dominant force off the field, the IPL and everything else. You can't say to that level of person, oh, but in the 80s, we would have thought this was great because they didn't grow up in the 80s, right? The one thing I've learned about life is that it is very hard for any human being to understand any period of the world that they do not have a direct relationship with, right? Their lived-in experience suggests that India should have won more trophies, so India should have won more trophies. And Ram with the hat trick here. If IPL awards are modified to use smart stats and given based on true average strike rate, how much difference would it make compared to the orange and purple caps, which are for all practical purposes meaningless? I have an awards thing coming up. We actually did a rough version of it on Cricket 8 during one of the washed out games, but I'll be going through this and they will be using true stats and everything else, in our judgments. So Virat Kohli is, I can tell you straight away, actually, I think that the purple cap winner is probably the best bowler this year, right? And I would say that the orange cap winner is probably going to be, it's going to be Kohli, isn't it? And he would not be my best batter. So, yeah. So I think they're 50%, but there are many years where the best bowler has the purple cap winner has not. I can never remember the caps, by the way, but I think I've got that right. There are plenty of years when the best bowler is not the person who takes the most wickets, and yeah, it is a little bit ridiculous. That's why we did the MVP awards for him. So if you go over to the main page and you put in IPL MVP, you'll see us going through the years with true stats to look at who the best players actually were compared to who we talked about. And look, most of the players, if you make 800 runs in a year or 700 runs in a year, you're still certainly in contention. So we have Travis Head as our best all-round batter. So our the real orange cap, I've called the award. but Kohli, I think, was probably the closest to him, right? We had Kohli right up there as well. So, you know, the numbers stats still make a big difference. And I think Kohli still had a really good year, especially the second half of it. But yeah, if you use true stats, there are many different years that pop that didn't get as much credit as they should have at the time. So 100% with you there. All right, let's take a quick break so I can read the comments and see what is in the comments that we can chat about here.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Stressed about pests? When you have pest problems, don't call just anyone. Call the Orkin Pro. For more than 120 years, Orkin offers unparalleled service, helping protect homes and businesses from termites, rodents, mosquitoes, and other insects. With Orkin by your side, you don't have to wonder about the outcome of your pest problem. We'll solve it guaranteed. And if bugs creep up between services, we'll be on your doorstep free of charge. Orkin, the best in pests. Learn more at Orkin.com.
All right. We've got a couple of super chats and some other questions as well. So let's get to all of them. Shara says, thank you for all your support, Shara. Why did England introduce the 100 and disrupt the summer fixtures instead of rebranding the Blast like how Australia rebranded the BBL? Australia didn't rebrand the BBL, though, did they? They actually did change it quite dramatically because they brought in the extra two teams and everything else. But Australia is a city-based league anyway, right? So Victoria is a Melbourne-based team. New South Wales is a Sydney-based team. Queensland is a Brisbane-based team. So it didn't have to change things as much. Whereas that's not quite the case of how county cricket was being run for all the different teams, right? You know, not all of those, you know, Taunton is not a particularly big place, for instance, right? Chelmsford is not a particularly, I think it's a town, barely, right? Is that right? Or is a city barely, isn't it? I think it's a city barely, right? And there's a few places that are, you know, quite tiny. And so what they were trying to do is take the teams to the biggest demographics and then also rebrand everything and make it smaller. They just had too many sides, right? And I think it comes down to that. They could have done the 100 in a million different ways, if we're being honest. They could have just said, we're going to give all the biggest cities every county side's going to get a 100 side, but there's going to be a Division 1 and there's going to be a Division 2 and they're all going to have to play under slightly different names, you know, city-based names rather than anything else or whatever that, or you know, different kind of regional-based names or whatever. They could have gone there, but they were trying to make it more like football and franchise sport and less like cricket. Because that is what the Big Bash had done, and that is what the IPL had done, and it made the most sense to them, and so they went down that route. But there was plenty of mistakes they made with the 100. The 100 was a panic, because for 30 years they hadn't really engaged their own fans correctly. They hadn't grown the game, they hadn't developed the fan base, and so if they had played better in all that time, they could have changed things quite dramatically at that point. And instead, they went completely the other way. And yeah, it's a panic. The 100 comes from panic. Indie Guy says, Celtics and Tatum will choke in the finals. Western Conference Finals is the real winners. Luka will win his first ring. love this has become a basketball podcast. Okay. I think Nuggets were the only team set up to beat the Celtics. Porzingis' knee is very interesting. But the big problem I'm going to have is whether it is Luka or whoever or Minnesota who make it through the finals. I just think they're going to have to have played so many hard games, whereas the Celtics don't look like they will have to play as many hard games. So tiredness is going to play a huge part in this, right? And it's no different than cricket. You know, if you have a great bowling attack and the other team has a great bowling attack, but your batting is terrible and their batting is good, your bowlers get tired, right? And so in the end, that plays a big part. So I'm kind of with you. I actually think the Celtics half court game doesn't make any sense in a playoff setup, but I think they're going to be so much fitter and stronger, come the playoffs, if Porzingis is around, that won't matter. If Porzingis isn't around, I definitely expect. I think Denver, Minnesota, and Dallas, and even OKC are all on or thereabouts on Boston's record. The reason that Boston's level, the reason that Boston has a better record is because they were playing a bunch of Eastern Conference teams over and over again, right? And I think that does change things quite a bit. Sriram says, why doesn't cricket have an NBA? Oh boy, is this every question? Why doesn't cricket have an NBA style playoff series? It's just too long, right? I mean, the ideal World Cup final would be a best of seven, probably at least a best of three. We used to have it, Sriram. You know, the old Kerry Packer days was a best of three, right? It is the best way of doing it. Everyone in cricket agrees with that. I don't think we're ever going to do it, but it's funny that you say, why doesn't cricket have an NBA style playoff series? What is a 5-test series? It's exactly that. And we know it's the best system. And yet for white ball cricket, we've never quite gone back to it. I think in the IPL is a perfect example of, if you make it through to the final, it would be great if we had three finals, best of three, right? I don't think we need to have best of five or best of seven, best of three. I'm more than happy to go with that. World Cup finals, I would say the same thing. I don't know if we're ever going to do it. There's financial issues and there's all sorts of things. Rahul says, who would you compare Phil Salt and Will Jacks as T20 players? Who has the highest ceiling? I think Will Jacks has the highest ceiling, probably because of the bowling and he can bat in a few more positions. Although I suppose Phil Salt can keep as well. Not well, but he can keep. I think Will Jacks. I'm a big fan of Will Jacks. And as much as I really like Phil Salt, I'm not sure I just don't think he has the ceiling of Will Jacks. I think that's what I believe. I'm not 100% sure, Raul, but I think that's what I believe. Tino says, has anyone in franchise cricket done the Tim Connolly challenge of putting together a title winning team and then creating the perfect team to beat them? I don't even know if that's how franchise cricket works, right? Like, I remember Muhammad Khan put together the Tallawallers and they won. And then I think he did one more year at the Tallawallers, left, and then came back to St. Lucia. But I don't think he was thinking he was trying to beat the Tallawallers because I think they'd kind of fallen apart by that point as well. It's harder with T20 cricket anyway, just because of the way it's not as long and consistent, you know, the mega auctions and all these sorts of things kind of don't allow the same sort of longevity of that. And it's immature, right? So I don't think that's the case. DM says, how did Martin Crowe conquer reverse swing? Martin Crowe basically worked out that all he had to do with the reverse swing was play for it hitting his stumps. Because if he played inside the line of the ball and it swung back in, it would hit his bat. And he wouldn't be bowled. Whereas if it swung away and he picked it wrong, it was always going to miss the stumps by quite some distance, especially the amount of reverse swing that those guys were getting. From the where they pitched it, what's the best way of putting this? So the reason we don't have too many great bowlers who bowl outswing and inswing is you want to pitch the best deliveries of those two different balls in two different spots, right? It's why the wobble ball works really well, because the wobble ball, you can actually land the ball in the exact same spot and you want it to either seam away, go straight, or come in, and all three are in play. Whereas for swing bowling, if you're bowling in swing, you want to bowl outside off stump to swing it back into the stumps. If you're bowling out swing, you want to bowl it closer to the stumps and swing it away. And so with the reverse swing, what Martin Crowe worked out was that as long as you played to protect your stumps, it didn't matter about the away swing. Now, here's the genius of that. That basic concept is not incredible on its own. The genius is not then chasing the balls that start to swing away, because that is what your mind tells you to do. Oh, I've got to hit this. I've got to hit this. And that's when you start to edge the ball behind, right? And you start to get caught in the cordon or at gully or at point or in all those other positions. So the genius isn't the method. The genius is the commitment to not then chasing those other balls and going, I'm going to play and miss over and over again, and I'm going to look crap, but I don't care. And Martin Crowe is on that sort of Sachin Tendulkar level of midway through an innings, he can make a decision like that and back it up and go for it. Whereas most players would have to come up with that theory, think about it, go into the nets and work on it, and then come out and try and make it work. Martin Crowe is on that God tier level of thinking as a batter where he's like, I don't need to do any of that. Dugo says, is Tim David any good? He seems to be quite average, but when you look around, who could be considered better finishers? No, Tim David's definitely good, but he's very, very limited, I think, is the best way of putting him. So he reminds me a lot of Darren Sammy. In that last three overs or four overs, they are just absolutely incredible. And so I would say he's had a down year this year. He's probably his best year was, what, 2022? And in 2022, he had a strike rate of 216. And the last 2 years, he's had a strike rate of 158. And I think a big part of it is that teams have started working out that if you keep a spinner for him, you really limit his overall usage. But his ability to hit sixes and just muscle them away at any time is absolutely elite. I think the last two IPL years, he's just been a little bit down on his best. Well, I wonder if some of that is also Mumbai's form has played a part at times in that, and when he's come into bat and everything else. But I do think that he's a hard player to play because you need him for the last three or four overs and he doesn't bowl. And even with the impact sub, that causes some issues with your side. And then too often this year, Hardik Pandya came in at times when Tim David should have come in, when there wasn't going to be any spin bowled as well. So you have to maximize him correctly all the time. So he's a limited player with freakish skills. Era Guy says, how is Warne a better all-round cricketer than Jadeja? I don't think he's a better all-round cricketer than Jadeja. With longevity, maybe. What is this sentence? Jared, how is Warne a better all-round cricketer than Jadeja? With longevity, maybe. So you've already made the first claim that he is. But by the end of his career, Jadeja will average 40. Yeah, so, but no one, I can't remember if I said he was a better all-round cricketer. And I'm not sure I would 100% agree that he's a better all-round cricketer. But if you're asking, there are many players who are not better all-rounder, but their single skill is absolutely on a level that can take it away. And Jadeja averaging 40 in Test cricket is not a given anyway. Right? But let's say he ends up averaging 37, which I think is 38, which is fine. I think that's slightly higher than what he averages at the moment. He gives you much more flexibility with the bat, which I said before. His fielding isn't as important in test level as Shane Warne's is. So straight away, Shane Warne does give you a little bit more with the field, even if he isn't overall anywhere near the level of fielding as Jadeja. And then they're bowling, right? So the actual bowling averages are very, very similar as I can't remember who the first person was. Was it Josh who asked this question? But when you look at their overall records of their bowling, Jadeja's bowling average at home is 20.86, and away from home is around 33, maybe 32.5 ish. I'm trying. With neutral tests. I hate neutral tests so much, right? So let's have a look at Shane Warne's stats in comparison. At home, he averaged 26.39, and away he averaged 25.5. He took 362 wickets away from home at 25.5, and if you add in his neutral, I think that comes into even lower again. Played a couple of neutral tests as well. Right? So away from home, Jadeja has 76 wickets at 33. So it's not about all-round player, although Warne is an all-round player in many ways, even if he's not an all-rounder, but he gives you a little bit with the bat and he gives you one special skill in the field. Jadeja is an actual all-rounder. But the impact that Warne has with the ball is so monumentally bigger than what Jadeja gives you with the ball. Right. And that ability to use him pretty much any place. So let's just go back to Warne. Let's see if I can bring it up here. So Warne in Africa averaged 24. In the West Indies, he averaged 39. Some of those was when he was injured that last time he went. In Asia, he averaged 26. In Europe, he averaged 22. And in Australia, New Zealand, he averages 25. And Jadeja in Africa has 6 wickets in 2 matches. Good average, 25. In Europe, he averages 43. In Australia, New Zealand, he averages 32. And in Asia, he averages 21.3. And it was really good in the West Indies. He probably had even more spin wickets over there, right? But it's from no wickets, right? So Warner's still taken more wickets in the West Indies than Jadeja has. Warner took, where are we? Way more wickets in all these different places. So we know he could do it home and away, home and away, home and away in almost everywhere. As I said, outside of India, he's still a pretty good stock bowler in India at times, but certainly not a great bowler. Whereas Jadeja is more of a stock bowler most places outside of Asia, right? If you're asking who I'm going to pick, I'm generally going to go with the more incisive bowling option when it comes to in any situation outside of maybe a few key players, you know, maybe, you know, guys like Sobers and Callis, right? But Warne is absolutely next level. Warne and Murali, absolutely next level at being able to take wickets everywhere and travel around the world. Keshav says, Kohli said in an interview that he upped his strike rate this season because of the extra batter at 8, which proves your Evan Goldbliss effect. Yes! But going by India's squad at the World T20, you think Kohli would go back to his old self? I think India is planning to bat deep till number 8 in this World Cup. And so if that is the case, then Kohli should continue to bat that way. And if he doesn't, then it's on him. Tikshana Praveen says, do you think that cricket has too many variables? For instance, pitches, grounds, conditions, balls, compared to other sports. What are your thoughts on that? Does it make the sport better or worse? I don't even think you've named all the variables. Yes, it does. That's why it's great. It cannot be conquered. Look, I've said this way too many times, but I'll say it one more time because I probably haven't said it on Wagon Wheel in a long time. One of cricket's great advantages over every other sport is that we play on living grass, and living grass gives absolutely no shits about what we are doing. You look at Wimbledon. Over the course of that tournament, that court will change quite a bit. It doesn't change massively in the match. Day 1 to day 5, we are seeing T20 games in this IPL where the pitch has played completely different in the first innings to the second innings. And we can check it up and look at it. Dew, swing, humidity, rain, sun, lights. It's incredible, our sport. Try and conquer all that. To be great at our sport, you need to be incredible in Guyana, where the ball never gets above your ankle. And you need to be incredible in the Whacker, where everything bounces up at your throat. All right? You need to be incredible on pitches that ping off sideways because of seam or swing or spin. And you need to be great on the flat tracks of other places. Right? And then if you want to go even more incredible with our sport, then we're like, oh, now we're going to add different formats with different challenges, with even different equipment. Come on. That's why cricket is so great. It is unconquerable, right? You always hear things like, oh, they've worked out baseball. They've worked out basketball. They've worked out football, right? We don't do that in cricket. The wobble ball was unplayable for 4 years. And then our batters are like, we've got this. We're just going to hit the ball harder. Reverse swing. Do you remember? Reverse swing. It's cheating. It's cheating. No one can play it. Reverse swing. People handle it now. The wrong'un. The wrong'un came in and they literally said the wrong'un is going to ruin cricket forever. It's a good ball, but almost no one bowls a wrong'un in test cricket anymore. And that was where they were dominating back in the day. It moves. It changes. It evolves during a game. There isn't another sport like cricket. It is completely and utterly on another level to every other sport when it comes to that kind of stuff. That is the genius of cricket. Now, we might, especially in T20 cricket, want to make it a bit more uniform in the future. I'm assuming we will have hybrid pitches, which is another evolution of the game, right? We just keep evolving the game, but we will eventually have hybrid pitches. So maybe we will be slightly more uniform, but that won't stop the day that, you know, that won't stop the fact that one day Ashdeep Singh will pick up a ball in 8 years' time and he'll come in to bowl it and it won't swing at all. And the bloke and the next bowler who bowls on the same day in the same conditions, maybe nothing has changed. They're both under lights or they're both in the sun or whatever. And the next bowler will pick it up and it will hoop around the corner. All right? These things will always happen and they will continue to happen. Cricket is a magnificent game from that point of view. And I love the fact that we play on grass and grass gives no shit about our sport. It's perfect. It's the perfect story of cricket. Last one for today. Sorab says, what does a batter have to do to be rated above Donald Bradman? Surely no one is going to average 100 more. You would need a 25-year career of being 25% better than the next best greatest batter, probably. I think that's, if you had a longer career, you played more because of the war, you played more formats, you played more, all these sorts of things, you would have to do that. But you would have to be 25% better than the second best player. I don't think we'll ever see that again. I think some of Bradman's dominance is because the rest of the cricket world hadn't developed, right? But at the same time, England had plenty of chances to have a Bradman, and the closest they got was Hobbs, and Hobbs is incredible. I think the three greatest batters in the history of our sport are Bradman, Hobbs, and Tendulkar. And Hobbs and Tendulkar are just nowhere near Bradman, really. I think you can make a claim that Tendulkar could be the greatest player of all time, as in he has a claim to that throne. Greatest batter of all time, I mean. I think you make a claim to that throne for the longevity and the kind of career he had, how brilliant he was in multiple different ways. But that would be if it was going up against Hobbs. But because he's going up against Bradman, it's like you could say he has a legitimate claim for number one, but he doesn't because Bradman has the claim for number one. So you're playing for second spot. I don't think anyone will ever have another record like Bradman. I think he was just a man so ahead of his time. But just to say this, I'm not sure that Grace wasn't also very similar. So, you know, Grace, Hobbs, Bradman, Tendulkar all were just so different than the rest of the players that they played against at that period. So, yeah, you certainly have an element of that. Anyway, that's it for me for today. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel, and we will be back again. We'll be doing a scoreboard tonight from the game. So I'll be back on this channel tonight. Oh, wait, sorry. Dushara says, some words on Pathirana. Sold for the highest in the Lanka Premier League. I didn't see that. I think CSK, I would have them as favourites to win the whole thing if he had played the whole season. I think he was that good this year. Absolutely on another level. Brilliant cricketer. Loved watching him play. Don't know how you handled him. He cut out some of the wides even. Not all of them, of course, but some of them. Just absolutely next level brilliant, genius bowling. And I think if he had played all year at Chennai and was available now, I would have Chennai as favourites to win the whole thing. That's how good he was. And I don't think Chennai played all that good of cricket this year. He just is transformative in what he does. Yeah, there you go. That was me being nice. That's it. Thank you to everyone for the super chats. Thank you, everyone, to the chat chats. Thank you to everyone for everything, really. What more can I say on the Wagon Wheel? We will be back again, as I said, in a few minutes, probably. Oh, I'll be on Cricket 8. From 3 o'clock onwards as well. So I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel. Come over to Cricket 8 for our live watch along, then come back here for the scoreboard, then go over to the main channel for my other video. Oh my God, I'm doing a lot of work today. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you.
Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.